Also, tune into our New Year's Day special Wednesday. This coming year, 2020, marks the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which guarantees women the right to vote. We begin the new decade with our hour-long special about one of the most influential women in U.S. politics, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. After the death of her husband, President Franklin Roosevelt, she spearheaded the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights. President Harry Truman called her the First Lady of the World. And in case you missed it, go to Democracy Now! For our remembrance of Toni Morrison. This is Oprah Winfrey reading Toni Morrison's words.
Can't you see? We got a home right here in this rock, don't you see? We got a home in this rock, and if I got a home, you got one too. So grab it. Grab this land. Take this land. Hold this land, my brothers. Ain't nobody crying in my home. I want you to take this land, make it, my brothers, shake it, squeeze it, turn it, twist it, beat it, kick it, kiss it, whip it, stomp it, dig it, plow it, seed it, reap it, rent it, buy it, sell it, own it, build it, multiply it, and pass it on. You hear me? Do you hear me? Pass it on. Thank you.
Oprah Winfrey reading the words of Toni Morrison. You can watch the full Toni Morrison remembrance at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
It is 5 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. And coming up is just one more episode of Rising Up with Sonali. But first, I want to play you these advertisements. Or not advertisements, so much as messages.
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
Please, Mr. Redman, don't put me out in the street.
The Community Alliance of Tenants is working to increase awareness in Washington County of the statewide law SB 608 that was passed in early 2019. It limits rent increases and no-cause terminations for residential leases. There's a temporary bilingual English and Spanish hotline set up for Washington County renters with questions about SB 608. Rent increases, no-cause termination notices, and or lease non-renewal notices. Phone number is 503-644-3007. Again, that's the Renter's Right Hotline phone number for Washington County every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. through January 30th at 503-644-3007. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm right in the middle of solving that riddle known as raising the rent.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, President Donald Trump is facing pushback over his retweet of a post that named the alleged whistleblower whose complaint to Congress sparked Trump's impeachment. A constitutional lawyer named Lawrence Tribe told Salon.com that in outing the whistleblower, quote, Trump has violated yet another law. Tribe explained that the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act of 1998 outlaws actions by government officials or agencies that directly or indirectly encourage retaliatory actions against employees who legitimately perform a whistleblower role in the intelligence community, as the whistleblower in this case clearly did regarding a matter of urgent concern as determined by the Inspector General. Trump has repeatedly urged the exposing of the whistleblower and even suggested he face the death penalty for daring to file his complaint. The New York Times on Sunday published a lengthy expose entitled Behind the Ukraine Aid Freeze, 84 Days of Conflict and Confusion. The report is based on, quote, interviews with dozens of current and former administration officials, congressional aides and others, previously undisclosed emails and documents, and a close reading of thousands of pages of impeachment testimony. It paints a detailed picture of Trump's decision to withhold congressionally mandated military aid to Ukraine as leverage to demand political dirt on Trump's rivals, and how his scheme stopped in its tracks when the whistleblower filed his complaint. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney emerged as, quote, a key conduit for transmitting Mr. Trump's demands for the freeze across the administration. Additionally, there was much more internal opposition to the Ukraine scheme than previously known, and that Defense Secretary Mark Esper, State Secretary Mike Pompeo, and National Security Advisor John Bolton all expressed strong criticism of it. Another figure, Michael Duffy, an official with the Office of Management and Budget, has also emerged as the point person to the Pentagon, instructing them to freeze the military aid and keep quiet about it. Analysts are citing the New York Times article as severely weakening Trump's impeachment defense. Meanwhile, State Secretary Pompeo is scheduled to visit Ukraine this Friday to assure the Eastern European nation of ongoing American commitment to its defenses from Russia. Pompeo will be the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Ukraine since the controversial July 25th phone call between Trump and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. And Russian President Vladimir Putin reportedly called Trump on Sunday, speaking with him for the first time since the July Ukraine call. According to a statement from the Kremlin, Putin thanked Trump for the information shared via the special services that helped prevent terrorist acts in Russia. Several matters of mutual interest were discussed. An agreement was made to continue bilateral cooperation in the fight against terrorism, end of quote. The suspect in Sunday's New York stabbing at a rabbi's home apparently has no known ties to hate groups and has a history of mental illness. 37-year-old Grafton Thomas was arrested within hours of an attack at a private home of a Jewish rabbi in the New York suburb of Muncie, where a large Orthodox Jewish community lives. Five people were wounded during the two-minute attack that took place on Hanukkah. There have been a spate of incidents targeting Jews in New York City over the past few weeks alone. Mayor Bill de Blasio spoke alongside other community leaders in New York on Sunday about the attack.
People here represent all of Brooklyn, all of New York City. We are gathered in common cause to overcome this hatred. And I don't want people to forget that we have confronted hatred before in this city. We've confronted division.
That's New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio on Sunday referring to the stabbing attack at a rabbi's home in Muncie that injured five people. He also announced a plan to combat anti-Semitic attacks with a greater reliance on police and security cameras. Meanwhile, in Texas, violence broke out at a church in a town called White Settlement. An armed man opened fire, killing two people, before armed parishioners pulled out their own guns and killed the suspect. The name of the alleged shooter has not yet been released, and no motive is known. Defenders of gun proliferation are citing the attack as evidence that more rights for gun owners makes for a safer environment, even though the so-called good guy with a gun scenario is exceedingly rare. A new report found that 2019 had the highest number of mass shootings on record, with a whopping 41 incidents that took 211 lives. The overall homicide rate has paradoxically dropped. Bloomberg just published its Billionaires Index and found that the richest 500 people saw a whopping 25% increase in their already obscene levels of wealth over the past year. The top 500 richest people now sit on nearly $6 trillion, up $1.2 trillion over 2019. Veteran congressman and longtime civil rights icon John Lewis announced he is suffering from stage 4 pancreatic cancer. The highly celebrated 79-year-old Georgia representative has served 17 years in office and will be undergoing treatment for the disease that has low survival rates. He said, "I have been in some kind of fight for freedom, equality, basic human rights for nearly my entire life." He added, "I have never faced a fight quite like the one I have now." California retailers are struggling to comply with a new set of rules that go into effect January 1st over the data that they collect from shoppers. The sweeping new law, called the California Consumer Privacy Act, is modeled after a European law that protects consumer data from big companies that trade in user data. Reuters called it, quote, one of the most significant regulations overseeing the data collection practices of U.S. companies that, quote, lets shoppers to opt out of allowing retailers and other companies to sell personal data to third parties. The California law even requires retailers to place signs about the regulations inside brick-and-mortar stores. In international news, Defense Secretary Mark Esper announced on Sunday that the U.S. dropped bombs on Iraq and Syria aimed at an Iraqi militia group that Iran was backing. State Secretary Mike Pompeo referred to the bombs as, quote, precision defensive strikes, after the militia was identified as being responsible for strikes on Friday that killed a U.S. contractor in northern Iraq. The militia group, called Kataib Hezbollah, vowed retaliation against the U.S., and Iraq's government said it would reconsider its relationship with the U.S. The U.S. also dropped bombs on Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, this past weekend. The U.S. strikes were apparently aimed at the Al-Shabaab militant group and resulted in at least four deaths of people that the U.S. claimed were terrorists. The U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, has sharply increased its attacks on Somalia after President Trump unleashed the U.S. military. According to the Guardian newspaper, AFRICOM has killed more than 800 people in 110 airstrikes in Somalia since April 2017. And finally, UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, has just released a report detailing worldwide violence against children over the past year. As the 2010s come to a close, the UNICEF found that since the start of the decade, the United Nations has verified more than 170,000 grave violations against children in conflict. That's the equivalent of more than 45 violations every single day. Nations like Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen, where the U.S. has a deep military involvement, are epicenters of violence against children. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The suspect in the recent stabbing incident in Muncie, New York, who injured five people at a rabbi's home, has been charged with federal hate crimes. 37-year-old Grafton Thomas's web searches included references to Hitler and Nazi culture. He also apparently searched for the phrases, "Why did Hitler hate the Jews?" and "German Jewish temples near me." Like the suspects in the earlier Jersey City shooting at a kosher grocery store, the suspect may have been linked to a controversial group called the Black Hebrew Israelites. There has been a notable uptick in anti-Semitic incidents around the country at the same time as a growing crackdown on free speech supporting Palestinian rights. In an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, my guest Phyllis Bennis wrote, "I'm Jewish, I fight anti-Semitism, and I support Palestinian rights." Phyllis Bennis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written a number of books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terrorism, as well as Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. She now joins me to discuss this op-ed she wrote. Welcome to the program, Phyllis.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So first, it's just kind of horrifying to see this uptick in attacks, especially during the holidays. And I suppose Orthodox Jews in particular are a visible target because they are so visibly Orthodox Jewish. It's sort of like Sikhs who wear turbans or Muslim women wearing the hijab. They become vulnerable in particular to racists, right?
Absolutely. There's a clear correlation between white supremacy and racism and the kind of violent anti-Semitism that we're seeing on the rise. And of course, you're right that Orthodox Jews are particularly vulnerable because they stand out, the kind of clothes they wear, the way they appear, and because their tradition requires a level of closeness, because they're not allowed to use transportation, to drive a car, for instance, on the Sabbath. So they cluster in communities where there tends to be larger groups, so they're more identifiable. And in the recent past, that seems to have made them more vulnerable.
So I want to talk about
It is important to see this in the context of the rise of white supremacy right. around the country.
Yeah, and so I want to talk first about the latest two incidents that have actually been linked to black suspects linked in this group, the Black Hebrew Israelites, but then broaden the conversation to the upticks in anti-Semitism in general. These last two incidents in particular suggest that maybe it's not so cut and dry, that there is some nuance and complication when we talk about anti-Semitism, right? Who are the Black Hebrew Israelites? There are some well-known people. The rapper Kendrick Lamar identifies with this organization.
I'm not an expert in the organization. My sense of having seen them around in New York for many years is that they have a fairly wide range of politics. It seems that there is at least alleged to be a kind of violent component to it that is explicitly anti-Semitic. It's based on a theological claim about Jewish, white Jews in particular, I think, are targeted as being false Jews, and that the real Israelites, the real inheritors of biblical identity, are black. Now, I don't think it's necessarily something held by a large number of people. As you say, this is particular to the allegations of the two recent events. It's important that we recognize these are not clear convictions or anything like that. These are allegations of connections to something called the Black Hebrew Israelites, and it may be nothing more than a link to a website. We don't actually know if there was any kind of connection, and if so, what kind of connection. Mm-hmm. What we do know is that the overall rise in violent anti-Semitism that we've been seeing over the last several years, that included the horrific attack in Pittsburgh, where the Tree of Life synagogue was targeted and 11 worshipers there were killed, with the allegation that the shooter was claiming that the Jews, particularly this synagogue, were responsible for what Trump has identified as the evil of immigration coming to the United States because they supported the resettlement of refugees. In the synagogue outside of San Diego, similarly, it was a white supremacist who is alleged to have carried out this attack that killed one and injured more. So we're seeing that kind of violence in its attacks. We saw it in Charlottesville, where the call of the Nazis and the Klan, who were marching in their Unite the Right protest 2 years ago, had the chant, "Jews will not replace us." And they were the ones who were then identified by President Trump as including very fine people. There were very fine people among them. And so when you see that kind of enabling of white supremacy from the very heart of the US government, from the White House, from the president, then we have to look very carefully at how this rise of white supremacy and within it an anti-Semitic component that goes alongside the anti-black component, the anti-immigrant xenophobic component, the anti-Muslim component, all of these things are then linked.
And we also saw just a few weeks ago President Trump giving a speech to a pro-Israel group where he engaged in some of the most, awful anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic stereotypes and tropes, right?
Particularly long-standing tropes that have to do with the idea that all Jews are wealthy. He said in one of those meetings with Jewish Republicans, these are presumably his supporters, he says, "I don't like you, you're not very nice people, but you're gonna have to vote for me anyway because the Democrats want to tax the millionaires." So there was this assumption that every Jew in the room, every Jew in the country perhaps, he believes, is somehow rich, which is a long-standing false, of course, Jewish trope. In another incident, he was again meeting with wealthy Republican Jews who are long-standing contributors to the Republican Party and to his campaign. And he was talking at one point about his decision to recognize the Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights as a legitimate piece of land now under Israeli control, as it should be, you know, something like that. And he said, "I was standing with your prime minister when I made that announcement."
Right.
And here he's talking to a room full of U.S. citizens. The Israeli prime minister is not their prime minister. He is their president, whether they voted for him or not. But the notion that because they are Jewish, that Bibi Netanyahu is somehow their prime minister. And then he went even further in that same meeting, looked at Sheldon and Miriam Adelson, the very wealthy casino owners who have been the largest funders of Trump's campaign and among the largest funders of settlement activity inside Israel and the occupied territories. He looked directly at them and said, when he was talking about the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, he looked at them and said, "Sheldon and Miriam, I did it for you." So here he is saying, "I made this momentous, horrific decision at the request of my funders," something that he claimed falsely that Representative Ilhan Omar had said. She didn't say that, but she was accused of being an anti-Semite for having supposedly said that. He actually said it, and no one in that audience stood up and said, "Excuse me, Mr. President, aren't you making some bad assumptions here?" You know, nothing like that. Nothing
so
like that.
This particular president has really promoted an interesting paradox here in the United States, where under the watch of President Trump, U.S.-Israel relations are stronger than ever. He has made it very clear to Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. will basically tolerate anything Israel does, whether or not it affects Palestinians. And at the same time, here in the U.S., he has tamped down on Palestinian rights. All of that while he has some very, very high-level folks in his cabinet. His own son-in-law is Jewish American. So he has Jewish Americans within his own family. He's embraced Israel, and he has given a signal to white supremacists and directly engaged in anti-Semitic tropes himself. This right. is just very, I guess, Trumpian is the only word for it.
It is, although I would say he's hardly the first to have this disparity between being anti-Semitic in terms of anti-Jew, anti-Jewish,
which one would hope is the actual direct definition of that term, anti-Semitic.
Exactly. And at the same time, supporting Israel, supporting Zionism as a political movement. If you look at, for example, the central leaders of the Christian Zionist movement, who tend to be right-wing, fundamentalist, evangelical Christians, their theological reason for supporting Israel and supporting Zionism as a project, the notion of the, quote, ingathering of Jews into Israel, is based on a thoroughly anti-Semitic theology that says that the reason we want to support Israel and support the movement of Jews into Israel is because before the second coming can happen, before Christ can return, all the Jews have to be in Israel, in that part of the world. And when they do, then we can have the second coming, and all the Jews will have the choice to either convert or die.
Wow.
And I gotta say, as a Jew, that's not exactly a great choice to have, you know, that you either convert or die. But that is the basis of the theology for Christian fundamentalism and Christian Zionism. And again, it has that weird contradiction built into it that's thoroughly anti-Semitic and yet is the greatest level of support for Israel. In fact, if you ask Israeli officials or ordinary Israelis, so what do you think about getting all this great political support from these people who say that you should have the choice to either convert or die? The answer is usually a sort of shrug, and it's like, oh, come on, we know that that's all nonsense. Mm. We don't believe any of that. But we will take the support from wherever we get it.
Wow.
So it's a built-in contradiction, for sure.
So pro-Israel, but anti-Jewish.
Exactly.
Let's talk about how this has, the pro-Israel push has also, of course, translated into a very severe crackdown on the First Amendment right of Americans who want to speak up about Palestine, Palestinians. This is a story we've been covering on our show for a long time with the attacks on the BDS movement, especially on campuses, pro-Palestinian groups, and Trump's, of course, recent executive order equating Jewish with being an ethnic group, being part of an ethnic group, precisely to crack down on campus activism around Palestine and Palestinian rights. We had talked to a young activist from Jewish Voice for Peace about this issue, but you wrote about it in your op-ed in the LA Times. So lay out your argument for us. How do you explain this to someone who just, you know, takes for granted that anti-Israel bias is equivalent to, or anti-Israel sentiments are equivalent to anti-Semitism?
Well, I think there's two issues that are underway here. One is this notion that criticizing Israel is somehow anti-Semitic. You know, sometimes supporters of Israel accuse critics of Israel of holding Israel to a different standard. And they say, well, you should hold Israel to the same standards as every other country. The reality is they are the ones that are holding Israel to a different standard. We can, and we do, criticize all kinds of countries for all kinds of human rights violations. I don't know if any of those folks have been out at the protests at the Saudi embassy, for instance, for the massive violations of human rights that Saudi Arabia routinely commits. But that's a long-standing movement to condemn U.S. support for Saudi Arabia because of its human rights violations. In the case of Israel, the notion is that if you criticize Israel, you are somehow criticizing Jews, and therefore it's anti-Semitic because you're therefore anti-Jewish, because Israel claims to be the state of the Jewish people. Now, this is particularly tricky because in the last year, Israel has passed a law, what they call part of their basic law, which is essentially equivalent to a new piece of the Constitution. If we had a new constitutional move in the U.S. to amend the U.S. Constitution, it would be the equivalent of that. It's not just a law, it's a very big deal law. And that law is called the nation-state law, and it says that only Jews have the right of self-determination in Israel, despite the fact that 20% of Israeli citizens are not Jewish. They're Palestinians, they're Christian, they're Muslim, they're whatever they are, but they're not Jews. And so it explicitly says that those 20% of citizens have no rights, no rights in the country that the rest are bound to accept. That isn't even talking about the Palestinians who live under Israeli military occupation. We're just talking about the citizens of Israel who are not Jewish. So once they pass that law, they're saying that we speak in the name of Jews. They claim to speak for me because I happen to be Jewish. They are not my country. That is not my government. They do not speak for me. And yet, they make the claim that they do, and they have popularized that claim so that people believe if you criticize Israel, you're criticizing Jews. If you condemn Israel, you're condemning Jews. It's those of us, whether we're Jewish or not, who make the distinction between the state of Israel and its government and Jews around the world. We're the ones who are saying, no, no. You know, Jews around the world are not responsible for what Israel does in their name. So that's the distinction that gets lost here. The other side of it is, the irony, of course, is that the Civil Rights Act, Article 6 of the Civil Rights Act, which talks about discrimination based on race, color, or national origin, it explicitly does not include religion. So that the widespread and rising attacks on Muslims, for instance, is not protected officially under Article 6 of the Civil Rights Act. Attacks on Catholics is not included here. None of those. And in practice, Jews have been protected. When there is clear attacks on the rights of Jews as Jews, it has been investigated by the Justice Department over years. I talked to people in the Department of Education who say that it's understood that even though Jews are not officially a race or a color or a national origin, it is sometimes used as the basis for investigating anti-Semitic attacks. So it's not as if there hasn't been a way to actually protect Jewish students or other Jews from anti-Semitism. This is different. This is saying, number one, that the definition of national origin includes Jewishness. And I wanted to say in my op-ed that, I'm sorry, Jared, you might be Jewish yourself, but you don't get to say whether Jews are suddenly defined as national origin. My ancestors didn't come from what is now Israel, what used to be Palestine and what is now Israel. They came from Eastern Europe. They had been in Eastern Europe for as long as anybody can ever remember. Hmm. So this notion that it's somehow only white Jews, that's the assumption, and that they're all somehow part of the same national origin. What does that say about Ethiopian Jews? What does that say about Chinese Jews? What does that say about the numerous Jews who are Arabs, who come from Iraq or from Morocco, or who are Iranian or are Turkish, or who came from Moorish Spain? All of these people are just as Jewish as the white Eastern European Jews like me, who some people seem to think are the only ones out there. There are black Jews, there are brown Jews and yellow Jews. So the notion that Jews are all one race or one color or one national origin is simply a racist erasure of the fact that there are Jews of all races and all colors.
Phyllis, in a response to your op-ed in the LA Times, one reader of the LA Times, Jonathan Jacoby from Sherman Oaks, wrote that your op-ed promoted a conflation that lumped together Israeli annexationists with progressive Zionists who actively support Palestinian rights. He writes that you correctly defended the right to boycott but did not address any catastrophic impacts on Israel were the boycotters to succeed. I suppose he's writing that there are progressive Zionists who support Palestinian rights but oppose BDS. I know this might be sort of nitpicking, but what do you make of this critique?
Well, there's no doubt that there are people who oppose Israel's occupation of the West Bank, for instance, and oppose BDS, who are against the boycott movement. But it's important to recognize that the boycott movement was a call in 2005 from 170 Palestinian civil society organizations. It didn't come from any government. It didn't come from the Palestinian Authority or from anybody else. It came from trade unions and the women's associations and the youth groups, all the professional associations. My personal favorite is the Palestinian Dentists Union. We're a founding member of the BDS campaign. Wow. Calling on people around the world to engage in efforts at boycotts and divestment campaigns and sanctions efforts with a very specific aim: to pressure Israel using nonviolent methods here, to pressure Israel to end three kinds of international violations of human rights and international law. It's not, we're going to boycott Israel forever because we don't like Israel. It's very specific. So when the writer of that letter indicates what would happen if the boycott succeeded, what would happen when the boycott succeeded is that it would end. The boycott would succeed when Israel stops its violations, its occupation of the 67 territories, its denial of the right of return of Palestinian refugees, and its refusal to allow Palestinian citizens of Israel to have equal rights. When those three violations end, the boycott is over. So when the writer says, what would happen? What would be the catastrophic result if the boycott should succeed? My answer is, the boycott would be over. That would be pretty great. Hmm.
And so a lot of these attacks on First Amendment rights are based on ignorance about what BDS is, just as what anti-Semitism is based on, ignorance, right? Real anti-Semitism, yes. Anti-Jewish racism is in the Absolutely. End based on ignorance.
It is, and it's unfortunate that it's so rooted in the history of racism in this country. Yeah. You know, if you look back at modern anti-Semitism, which you can trace back to around the lynching of Leo Frank in 1915 by the Klan, that was the rise of the new sort of modern anti-Semitism. It's been now 100 years of that legacy where it's linked to the anti-racism the anti-black racism of the Klan and other violent organizations like that. There was a lynching of a white man, a Jew in Tennessee in 1868, right after the Civil War, at the beginning of Reconstruction. That was from an earlier period. And then that period kind of ended, the Klan reemerged, the modern Klan, took on anti-Semitism as much as it did anti-black racism in this country. And all of it was linked to white supremacy. When you saw those Klan members and Nazis in marching in Charlottesville in 2 years ago, when they were chanting, "Jews will not replace us," it was linked to this so-called replacement theory, which is this right-wing white supremacist theory that is based on whipping up fear and ignorance among some white people in the United States, as well as in Europe and elsewhere, that says that people of color, and it can be different in different places, it might be Muslims in one place, it might be black people in other places, it might be Jews, people of color are somehow going to take over the white majority of whatever country we're talking about and are going to replace them. So there's this vicious chant, "Jews will not replace us," meaning we will remain in power, we will remain the dominant force, and those Jews will not be allowed to be equal to that. That's really the essence of what that chant is all about.
Well, Phyllis, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your op-ed from our website. Thanks, as always, for all the work you do.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's also a prolific author, and we've been discussing her new op-ed in the LA Times called "I'm Jewish, I Fight Anti-Semitism, and I Support Palestinian Rights." I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. On December 20th, 2019, the U.S. military established a sixth branch, signed into law by President Donald Trump as part of the National Defense Authorization Act. Space Force, which started out as an idea that Trump promoted in the early days of his presidency, came into being with little to no opposition from both major parties, and is the start of U.S. militarization of space. Proponents of Space Force say the U.S. has to be militarily supreme in space in order to counteract China and Russia. But at what cost? My guest is Carl Grossman, professor of journalism at State University of New York College at Old Westbury, and is the author of the book The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. He's an associate of the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and his latest article is called "The Very Bad Space Force Deal." Welcome to the program, Carl.
Pleasure to be with you.
So this particular deal to bring Space Force into being, I mentioned, had little to no opposition, but we're sort of hearing that there was a deal that had to be struck in order to make it happen, and that was for federal employees to get paid parental leave. Was there really, truly opposition by anybody to the creation of Space Force? And when I say anybody, I mean elected officials.
Well, there were some Democrats who voted against this National Defense Authorization Act, including here from New York, Jerry Nadler, who is chair of the Judiciary Committee, among others. But a majority of Democrats voted with Republicans for this NDAA, which would establish a Space Force, a sixth branch of U.S. Armed Services. And according to a number of reports, a deal was worked out by Jared Kushner. And in return for the Democrats voting for this Space Force, what the administration provided was, as you mentioned, paid leave for civilian government employees, which in fact is common around the world. So, I mean, it was quite a trade-off for parental leave. The Democrats voted for, well, frankly, what I think is going to be a tragedy of historical proportions. What we have here is sort of an encore of Reagan's Star Wars. We have the United States now moving to weaponize the heavens.
If you look at the new Space Force website, and it has a website now, spaceforce.mil, there's a photograph right on there showing a couple of military folks. In the background, it says, "Where space superiority begins." They're not pretty. It doesn't seem that they're hiding the fact that this is essentially for the U.S. to be the supreme military force in space, just as the U.S. military is the supreme and the strongest force on Earth, right?
Now, over and over again, is that it's not enough to have American presence in space. We need to have American dominance in space. And that's why he's been pushing successfully. He signed the NDAA establishing this Space Force. Now, this flies in the face, and it's so important to understand, flies in the face of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. That's the landmark treaty. It's put together by the United States, the former Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom. And it prohibits weapons of mass destruction in space, and it designates space as a global commons for peaceful purposes. What the U.S. is doing is saying, forget about the Outer Space Treaty, as in fact the Trump administration in recent time has said, let's forget about this treaty and that treaty. And let me also add to this, for the last 20 years now, Russia, China, and our neighbor Canada have been seeking to broaden, to expand the Outer Space Treaty to prohibit any weapons in space, not just weapons of mass destruction. It's called the PAROS, for Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space Treaty, and they want to keep the Outer Space Treaty, in fact, broaden it to retain space as a place for peace. But what's occurred over and over again with Republican presidents and Democratic presidents is the United States at the United Nations has voted no to the PAROS Treaty. I've been at the UN and I've seen the no vote. And what the U.S. has been doing is essentially vetoing the PAROS Treaty. And so when I hear that the U.S. needs to have this Space Force to counter Russia and China in space, Russia and China very, very much, and I've been to China, I've spoken to Chinese officials, I've been several times to Russia, and these countries don't want to blow their national treasuries on deploying weapons in space. They want to keep space for peace. And it's shamefully, frankly, it's our country, the United States, which, and now with Trump, like with Reagan, pushing, turning space into an arena of war.
Right. If there was an agreement from all countries to basically leave space alone, to leave the war fighting to planet Earth, there would be no question of who reigns supreme in space. Essentially, when you take away that agreement or any sense of an agreement, you start yet another arms race. What's really interesting and fascinating to me about this whole issue around Space Force is how those people who might consider themselves very liberal get literally starry-eyed, pun intended, by this idea of a Space Force. Even the font on the Space Force's website is this Star Wars, you know, science fiction style font. And we've had decades of, you know, Hollywood glamorizing and romanticizing the idea of military, you know, of a military culture in space, right? When people imagine Space Force, they're thinking maybe of Star Trek or any of these sci-fi TV shows and movies that romanticize this idea. And it seems as though the US military and Trump have very much taken advantage of this, that this idea that it's going to, you know, we for us to establish a space force is a very glossy, romantic notion of an armed force keeping the peace in space.
Well, this Star Wars scenario is no film. It's no movie. It's no work of fiction. But I did a TV documentary, it's online, Star Wars Returns. That's when George W. Bush and Dick Cheney achieved power, and they were going to revive Reagan's Star Wars, his plan. It's, and the architecture of the Reagan Star Wars, which is what we're heading for with a Space Force, orbiting battle platforms, and on them, hypervelocity guns, particle beams, and laser weapons. And to top it off, these weapons need a lot of energy. So the plan was to have nuclear reactors aboard these battle platforms, providing the power for these weapons. In fact, I also wrote a book called Weapons in Space, and I mentioned the documentary. In both, I quote James Abramson, who was the commander of the Star Wars program, called for a time the Strategic Defense Initiative, saying that without reactors in orbit, we're going to need a long, long extension cord from Earth bringing up power. But in any case, what would be overhead would be these horrid weapons, these battle platforms, and nuclear reactors. And as I note, Russia and China have not wanted to move up to space and get involved in weaponizing space. But with the U.S. doing this, I guaranteed they're not going to sit still. They're going to respond in kind. And consider a shooting war with battle platforms and hypervelocity guns and laser weapons and nuclear reactors above our heads and the debris, a lot of it radioactive debris, raining down. I mean, for those who are or Trekkies who are into space, we would not be able to get a rocket off Earth out into space for eons, because there'd be so much debris, not to mention the lives lost, the huge amount. I mean, space war would be a calamity, not an entertaining film.
There's also the issue of the cost. We're told there's no money for Medicare for All. Let's cut food stamps. Let's trim all of those programs that taxpayers fund out of their pockets for other taxpayers. Let's instead throw more money at the military. The entire National Defense Authorization Act package ran into $738 billion. Of that, some portion designated to Space Force, but in the future, if Space Force is now a formally established branch of the military, I can imagine future years where that aspect, that line item in the Pentagon budget is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, because now we've opened the door.
Well, it's going to be billions upon, it's been said by those in the aerospace industry, that a Star Wars system would be the biggest industrial enterprise, in world history. As to how the money would be raised for the hundreds for the space warfare systems, entitlement programs, and I follow the space industry trade journals, and what they've been talking about is taking it from Medicare, taking it from Social Security, this money. I mean, not only are they going to try to take our lives, they're gonna go to take our money.
And so that aspect you just raised is absolutely key. The aerospace industry, which has a lot of lobbyists in Washington, D.C., are among the biggest beneficiaries of such a program, right? I mean, yes, of course, there'll be some jobs for technicians. There'll be new military recruits. But by and large, we're talking about a massive windfall for corporations that make, that will be making the hardware that Space Force will require.
Yeah, for regard to this program, some might say, no, this all can't be happening. In fact, since I wrote that article that appeared in Counterpunch, and it's online, what the U.S. military, the Pentagon has put out as its plan to change the name of various U.S. Air Force bases to U.S. Space Force bases. Hmm. And the communities, for example, Peterson Air Force Base, the Schriever Air Force Base, I'm sorry, in Colorado, that would become the Schriever Space Force Base. So the political combination here has been the aerospace industry. Folks like Boeing. I mean, not only have they been busy screwing up the 737, they're up to their neck in military contracts. And there was a congressman from the Seattle area, a Democratic congressman, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, who was a leader, and let me see if I can get his name, I think it was Lee, in pushing for this National Defense Authorization Act, providing for the creation of a space force. So you have the aerospace industry pushing, you have, and ultimately you'll have even more so of this, places where components of this space force will be based, and then you have Trump, this preposterous U.S. president we have, who actually originally started talking about, and I've written about this too, and others have, in fact, National Public Radio had a piece about initially when Trump started talking, it was a little group of Marines in California, and he mentioned maybe we'd have a space force, and he got a big laugh, and then later he said, well, maybe we should have a space force.
Right, it sort of started out as this flippant remark during a speech that just has now snowballed into being part of a law that he signed.
Yeah. And maybe I can note how I got into this, if you call it a story. I broke the story in The Nation magazine back in 1986 about how the next mission of the Challenger, the shuttle, which was planned for May of 1986, involved there was to be a little rocket, space probe, basically, on board, powered by plutonium. And in The Nation, I wrote this editorial was titled The Lethal Shuttle for The Nation, which was published front page, about if that the accident had occurred in May of 86, not January of 86, it would have been more than seven brave astronauts dying. I mean, you wouldn't want to go to Disney for a few centuries. I mean, if that plutonium was dispersed, particularly as dust, plutonium is regarded as the most radioactive substance that exists. It would have been an enormous disaster. And then I kept wondering about what did they need a plutonium fuel space and so forth. Like just a few years ago, NASA launched a space probe, went to Jupiter, and solar panels, photovoltaic panels, provided the onboard power, not plutonium. And as I dug deeper and deeper into this question, I began to see how NASA and the U.S. military have embraced the use of nuclear power in space, running kind of in parallel. And then I got into the architecture of Star Wars, what I was mentioning before, of these nuclear-powered hypervelocity guns and particle beams and laser weapons on battlefield platforms above our heads. That started me, and I've been on this issue for more than 30 years.
Mm-hmm. So we now have a situation where this Space Force has become a reality, handed to Trump by Democrats and Republicans. I should mention, at the same time that the Democrats were impeaching Trump, Donald Trump is going to go down in history as a president that created Space Force. And unfortunately, that's going to be one of the marks of distinctions, positive distinctions of his presidency rather than negative distinctions. There's been so much sort of, going back to what I was saying earlier about the kind of romanticization of this idea of a Space Force. There's been so much glossy media coverage, headlines, talking about why we have to have a Space Force and why it's such a great idea from, liberal outlets, not just the right-wing outlets. What do you think is needed? Do we need a very strong public education campaign to remind Americans, just as destructive as the ground military is in terms of the wars we fight, the money that it sucks up, the people that it kills and maims, and the PTSD, that a Space Force would be essentially more of the same?
Well, I think people have to know about this, and I'm a professor of journalism, and the coverage of this space, have you seen it on the NBC News or ABC? Have mm-hmm. you seen stories in news? The mainstream media, they've been nowhere on this. People don't know, and people have to know, and then people have to take action. And the organization I would suggest people get involved with, the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And again, they go together. You can connect to the Global Network on its website. It's www.space4peace.org. It's based in Maine. They have international conferences and protests and so forth. People are going to have to get active. I feel that what stupid things that people do can be undone. I mean, maybe that's looking through rose-colored glasses, but I think, for example, of what happened after World War I, and the world realized that the use of chemical weapons was horrific. All those deaths on the battlefields of Europe during World War I, and as a result, there was a series of treaties afterwards which banned the use of chemical weapons. Now, that hasn't been 100% subscribe to, but pretty much it's held. Here with space, as Craig Eisenroth in the film that I did, Star Wars Returns, says, he was a young State Department officer who involved in the creation of the Outer Space Treaty, which now incidentally has been signed onto by most nations of the world. He said the concept was to prevent war in space before it happened. So came the Outer Space Treaty. So it isn't like we have to do a new treaty, though the Paris Treaty would be good to add to the Outer Space Treaty. We should just stick with the Outer Space Treaty, insist that the Outer Space Treaty holds and space be retained for peace. But that's going to take, considering so many Democrats going along with this madness, considering the silence of so much of media, that's going to take grassroots action. And again, what I recommend is getting connected with and getting active with the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space.
And that is space, the number 4peace.org. And finally, I just want to also ask you, in light of the fact that we are struggling to figure out energy sources to run life, human life on the planet, with the climate crisis looming, you were mentioning earlier the amount of energy that it's going to require. Of course, we'll end up forcing more nuclear power in space, but it's just incredible that we're going to be wasting time, energy, and technology figuring out how to send up massive amounts of military hardware and weapons of mass destruction into space instead of figuring out how humans can survive on this planet without impacting our atmosphere, right? I mean, there's a climate change angle to this that I haven't seen climate justice activists link either.
Well, like on Earth, in space, there's no need for nuclear power. I mean, way back, we're talking here about the early 60s, satellites that were launched by the U.S. and the Soviet Union were powered by plutonium or actual little nuclear reactors. And then there were accidents. The biggest one biggest U.S. one, there's been a number of ones involving the Soviet Union and then Russia, was the Snap-9A accident in 1964, which didn't achieve orbit. The satellite came down. It broke up in the atmosphere. Plutonium was dispersed all over the planet. Dr. John Goffman of the University of California at Berkeley, an MD, a PhD, a giant in the area of radioactivity, connected that to a significant spike in lung cancer on Earth. And in the wake of the Snap-9A, the satellites, all our satellites now are solar powered. The International Space Station is solar powered. But we would develop this Star Wars program using nuclear because of the extremely high energy needs of these terrible weapons that are proposed. It's going backwards, right, in terms of what we know now, and the madness has to stop.
Well, Carl, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insight with us. We'll post a link to your article as well as the website that you mentioned on our site. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
My guest is Carl Grossman, a professor of journalism at State University of New York, and he has been writing about Space Force. We'll link to a couple of articles that he just published online about the issue. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Up next is Labor Radio.